Attention, please. I would like to introduce our next speaker. Again, I don't really think that Dr. LeClaire Bissell needs an introduction. I think many of us here know her personally, and most of us know of her. I will say a couple of things, that Dr. Bissell has been involved in this group for a very long time, and she's made numerous contributions to the field. She was formerly the president of the American Medical Society on Alcoholism. She's also been the medical director at ARUs. And most recently, a book came out, which she published, called Alcoholism in the Profession. I have the book, and though I haven't read it in its entirety, it's excellent. And I think for anyone who's interested in this particular topic, and I can't really understand that anybody here would not be interested in that particular topic, it's an excellent book, and I think it's worth reading. So I'd like to introduce Dr. Bissell and thank her very much for agreeing to talk to us today.
Hi, I'm LeClaire. Glad to be here. I was supposed to give a talk this morning, according to Bill originally, on new thoughts in alcoholism. And I'm not all that sure I have that many new thoughts. But I do know there are a lot of things going on that not all of us are fully aware of. Not that they're necessarily new, but there is action, you know, that passes by very frequently. And I think what I'll do is just give myself permission to bounce around a whole bunch of different topics and not try to get an organized talk together. Matter of fact, I could have a grand time just reacting to Dan and what he's been saying and some of the fights we've been having over whether we should even talk about self-help groups and if we shouldn't say mutual help groups in the first place. The first thing I want to do, by the way, is to say that I'm back in the research business and I need your help with that. When I did this book we've been talking about, I was badly advised, it was suggested to me that we limit the original study to physicians and dentists who were male, same thing for the attorneys, by the way, and the nurse studies to women. There was a lot of nonsense about you can't average tables and chairs and raging hormones and the usual garbage, which I fell for because I was not a feminist at the time, and this was a good 12 years ago. And the result was when the book finally came out, and my staff had forced me through a consciousness-raising group in the interim and all of those things, you know, here I was with people saying, that's very interesting. Now, does that also apply to women physicians? Does that also apply to women attorneys? And I was there with egg on my face, having to say I haven't the remotest idea. I didn't trouble to ask them. So what I'm now doing is asking your help in finding recovered alcoholic women, only women, physicians, attorneys, dentists, DVMs, who are willing to be interviewed face-to-face, nose-to-nose, breath-to-breath, by me or another recovered alcoholic woman doing this kind of work, okay? They have to be alcoholic, they have to consider themselves members of AA, and they decide what they mean by those two terms. If you say you're an AA member and you're drunk, I'm not going to quarrel with you. And we want them all to be sober from alcohol, not necessarily other drugs, a minimum of one calendar year as of the time of interview. So if anybody knows a woman, you know, who fits these requirements, who's willing for me to have her name and address, please let me know. Do not just hand me names and addresses of somebody that you think might not object. Because, as you know, if I get involved in anonymity breaks, I'm dead in the water on this kind of thing, and it just isn't worth it. Okay, let me share you some new thoughts that, as I warned you, are going to be kind of random. Again, at the time I wrote that book, I had looked at the impaired physician movement entirely from the position of the recovered alcoholic, later as a member of an advocacy group, which did not coerce in any way, still later as a member of some groups in and around the AMA who were struggling to put impaired physician committees together that were behaving in a variety of ways, some semi-coercive, some advocacy primarily, others, frankly, coercive and disciplinary. And this year, for the first time, I'm now a member of the Board of Professional Medical Conduct of the State of New York. So I'm seeing it with the disciplinarian's hat on. And I've learned some stuff that I wish people had told me years ago, and since a bunch of you are on impaired physician committees, let me try to share it with you. I think the first thing you need to know is that the boards are not the slightest bit interested, in most cases, in rehabilitation. Okay? That is not where they're coming from at all. This isn't the primary purpose. Not only that, but because of where you sit as a member of the board, what you see is medicine at its absolute worst. Now, the board in New York is not 7 and 8 years behind on its disciplinary maneuvers the way it used to be, but we are 2 to 3 years behind, which means that the ordinary garden variety alcoholic person is not going to be able to win our attention. That's not the one that we hear anything about or are particularly interested in. We're interested in the one who is raping small boys on the steps of St. Patrick's, where the public is upset. Okay? The mild case, you don't see. The really nice guy, you rarely see. And pretty soon, watching this procession go by, you begin to wonder why anybody ever had anything good to say about physicians ever. Okay? So this is your life experience as a board member. This tremendous procession of unattractive souls. Now, every board member was appointed directly or indirectly by a governor. And directly or indirectly by a commissioner of health or education or whichever department runs it in your state. So one of your first tasks is to make the governor look good and to make the commissioner look good, and then a little bit further down the line to see to it that the board looks good. This is largely a public relations maneuver. No one is ever, ever going to fault a board member for being too conscientious, being too suspicious, and protecting people too thoroughly. Okay? We can get faulted almost immediately if we are naive, unsophisticated, sentimental, and fail to take action when somebody is doing bad things to people, and that hits the press. Okay? So remember, you're seeing the worst of the worst. You got to make the governor look good, you got to make you look good. Then there's kind of a gap in priorities, and what you next see is that the board sees its role largely in terms of protecting the public. And some members of the board do take that quite seriously, and we see people suffering pretty badly from medical malfeasance. Later, and only much, much later, is the member of the board really concerned about whether or not somebody recovers and whether or not that person gets a fair shake and gets his license back. So if you want to get a board to listen to you when you are the advocate for yourself or a colleague, you know, who's had his license pulled and you want to get him or her back, you're going to have to realize that looking good is the prime concern, and although it may be totally unnecessary, you're going to have to come up with some sort of a system, some sort of monitoring thing, or some group of people who will take responsibility for this particular individual, so if the whole thing goes sour, you and somebody else looks bad, and not that board. And I think if you can keep this in mind, you'll be much more successful in your dealing with folks like me, when we are now sitting in those, committee hearings, okay? I wish I'd been clear about this some years ago. I hope it makes sense to you, okay? And this is the real world we're dealing with out there. Okay. I'm not going to talk too much about new material that came out of the research for the book, but some did. Most of it's there in print. You can find it. But there are a couple pieces of it that I'm now comfortable about that I wasn't before that I'd like to share with you. And one is that you're going to get asked all the time about the prevalence of alcoholism in professional groups. You know, do doctors have more? Do attorneys have more? Do airline pilots have more? Do nurses have more? And so on into the night. If it saves you some time, I can say with total confidence, nobody knows. All right, I've been through the literature to a fare thee well. We are citing opinions at each other. There is little or no hard data, but I can tell you what evidence there is on which the opinions are based that say that doctors have more alcoholism than other groups. Okay, this is leaving aside whether or not we use narcotics more than other groups. And in fact, it appears that we do, that any group, be it physician, nurse, you know, veterinarian, or what have you, who has easy and immediate access to narcotics will use them more readily than somebody who lacks that access. Okay? So the physician who only has to reach for it, or the nurse who just reaches for it, is more likely to use narcotics than the dentist, who legally is entitled to it, but doesn't necessarily store it in the office, might have to write a prescription, might have to go down the block to get it, and in many cases doesn't bother. Okay. How come people think doctors have more alcoholism? It's based, other than for the opinion business, on two things. A study done in England that would tend to indicate that doctors and nurses have more cirrhosis of the liver than do other professional groups. Okay? That has not been shown to be the case on this side of the Atlantic, but let's assume that the original study in England was accurate, and it looks pretty good, and that this is true. We do know that a liver which has been damaged by hepatitis virus is more likely to develop cirrhosis than a liver, you know, exposed to alcohol, which has not been previously damaged by hepatitis. And since doctors and nurses have handled blood products and are, of course, exposed to hepatitis B, it would not be terribly remarkable if we did have slightly more cirrhosis of the liver than other populations. So, first off, we're not sure we do. If we do, we only do in England. But if it's true in England, there's still another plausible explanation for it that does not necessarily mean that we're more likely to be alcoholic than other groups. One that's a little tougher to make go away, though, is that studies originally suggested by Max Glatt and then later confirmed by Robin Murray would indicate that examining a population of people in treatment, you're far too likely to find physicians as members of the inpatient treatment population. And when you allow for the total number in the population outside and compare them to other class 1 males, as Murray did, using attorneys as his comparison group, still in all, far too many doctors in treatment and relatively few attorneys. So the conclusion seemed to be that if you're a doctor or a nurse, you are more likely to have alcoholism because, look, there you are in this particular treatment facility. And that's where I think my work came up with some surprises for me, because I wasn't looking for this at all. I was looking to show how good it was to treat alcoholic people and how much less we then used our insurance policies and how much less we cost the community, you know, once we recovered. So I was asking everybody about how many inpatient admissions they had had during the drinking years and then how many admissions they'd had and for what, you know, in the sober years, you know, before I got to interview them. Okay. What we found was that the physicians and the nurses were many, many more times likely to have been treated as inpatients than were the attorneys, the social workers, and the college women. So in plain English, what Glatt and Murray were observing was entirely accurate, as far as we can tell. Doctors and nurses were in treatment more. It's just that as a group, we are more likely to go for inpatient care than are the non-medical people, and what they were really seeing was a different behavior. It's not necessarily that our alcoholism is more extreme or more severe or anything else that would account for our arriving in inpatient status. We just do, okay? And for what it's worth, the impaired attorney committees seem to be somewhat less likely to refer attorneys for inpatient treatment than are the impaired physician committees, some of whom, you know, discharge people wholesale into the 28-day rehabs, and some of whom even feel that if you're a physician, that automatically means not only do you have to have inpatient care, you have to have it out of state for a total of 4 months or it just won't work. The attorneys have not bought that notion in the slightest, so a lot of them are still recovering entirely as outpatients. Okay? So I think that may be some, you know, sort of an interesting fact. Do we know the prevalence? No. Can we explain the old studies that would indicate that doctors had more than other groups on grounds other than more alcoholism? Yeah, we can. It may still be true that we do. In fact, I could make a fairly good argument based on risk factors that probably we do, but nobody has that evidence. Now, the AMA got involved in the whole impaired physician movement in 1975, and incidentally, people have started grumbling about the term impaired physician. So let me flash back in history for a minute. Our first conference, San Francisco 75, we didn't use the term impaired physician. We were talking about disabled doctors. And what happened almost immediately was that right after that conference, when the thing hit the press, the phone started to ring, the letters started pouring in. All those nice people in wheelchairs were mad as hornets. They did not want their nice word, disabled, to be used for the druggies and the junkies and the crazies that we'd been talking about out in California. It was their word, and we were to lay off, please. All right? So basically, we went shopping for a word that nobody wanted. nobody had claimed the word impaired. So after an awful lot of backing and filling, that one was chosen, and that's where it came from. I think probably you could sell the, you know, a lot of folks on a different word, but you better make sure first that nobody's claimed it and that you're going to get in trouble again. But anyhow, AMA started this business for our profession in 1975 and has been having annual, or rather having meetings about every 2 to 3 years ever since. AOA did a policy statement the same year that the AMA did, but has never had a similar conference and has developed its doctor impairment groups much more slowly. The ADA will have the very first national meeting on the impaired dentist this year in Chicago in July on the 24th. And I hope you'll pass the word to the people you know who are recovered dentists, because I think we need to do two things. Get a good turnout in Chicago so that the ADA will see that people are interested. And then secondly, make sure that there are a bunch of people attending their workshops where things get too far off the beam and there's too much naivety and, you know, failure to understand what our disease is all about. There'll be people in the room, you know, who can raise their hands and jump up and down and, you know, give them a little bit more accurate feedback. Anybody who wants that, I have the number of the contact person, or just write to ADA in Chicago. The American Nurses Association had their first annual bash. There have been things called National Nurses Conferences on Alcoholism and the Impaired Nurse before, but they're national only in the sense that the people throwing them would be perfectly happy to have people from all over attend. Okay? They haven't had the backing of any truly national organization. The thing that made this year's one interesting is that the ANA got in the act, and so did the National Nurses Society on Addiction, and so did DANA, the Drug and Alcohol Nurses Association. And these three groups co-sponsored a meeting in Kansas City late in February. It was overpriced, $300 close to, for nurses. The dentists are charging $35. Underpublicized, and by the time they got around to dropping their rates, it was too late to get a super saver fare or to take advantage of any of the airline price wars, and the nurses just simply could not attend. But it was an excellent meeting for the small crowd that was there, and I think the beginning of some real movement there. My own personal feeling is that one of our tasks as recovered physicians is to help our recovered, you know, or hopefully about to be recovered colleagues that we're working shoulder to shoulder with all the time to get their own things together. It doesn't make much sense to me for me to write the perfect order as a physician if it's going to be carried out by a nurse who's bombed, you know? And I feel no better about going to a dentist who's, you know, stoned than I feel about, than Mark maybe does about having his airline people, you know, beaming him into Miami. Frankly, I'd like us to think of healthcare a little bit more broadly. And I think that means we really have to help people in the early organizational struggles. And believe me, nurses are absolutely evil to each other compared to the way physicians are. We simply do not permit each other to be dragged out in handcuffs from the place where we work. And to have the fact that we're accused, you know, given to the press immediately, long before we're convicted of anything, and then have no notification put in when the charges are dropped. We do not permit each other to have licenses arbitrarily pulled for 2 years if we're single parents and have no other way to earn a living, take care of our kids, and then have no clear indication of what we must do in order to get that license back. This happens to nurses all the time, and I'm not sure that they can fight this fight, you know, without some of our help. So let's do it if we can. Other new things that are going on, I think we're just beginning to see the AIDS crisis. That was mentioned already today. But this is a biggie, and it's a baddie, and we are people who understand stigma. We know what that feels like, and I think we're in an excellent position, you know, to help other people that the bigots are chasing. But completely aside from that, a lot of us are in the business of dealing with each other, with our colleagues who've been using needles and sometimes sharing them, and certainly those of us who are treating addicts who have been using things other than alcohol are certainly working with folks who are IV drug users, and they are needle sharers. This is part of the culture. Now, there's a big pool of AIDS out there that hasn't declared itself yet. But in certain areas, you're already feeling it. The block I live on in Manhattan, we've had two deaths on my side of the street, in addition to a third who is, who was living in my building originally. And I've had two lovers of friends, both of whom known to this group, but never out in this group, because even this group didn't make it safe for them to be out to you, Both of those men have died. I think this is just the beginning. Right now, New York is full of it. San Francisco is full of it, and so are the big gay centers. But I don't see this staying in the gay community, like, you know, particularly. I see it coming into all of the needle-sharing groups. And I think we have a double job to do. We have to think very hard about seeing whether or not we can't arrange for addicts are going to use anyhow to have clean needles and get educated that they shouldn't share them. And that's going to be real tough because it's going to look like we're in favor of doing drugs the instant we say that. And the other thing we're going to have to do is be very clear on how afraid we have to be of an AIDS victim and then communicate that to our counselors and to other patients. And it has to be put in terms that they can understand. Don't talk to them about viruses all that much. They don't dig viruses. What they need to hear is something pretty simple, like if you have a buddy with AIDS, hug him, share the table with him, share the Johnny seat with him, don't neck with him, and don't go to bed with him unless you talk it out with your doctor, okay? And this will put it in terms that they can kind of understand, all right? And that, I think, is about as, you know, as accurate and as simple as I can make it. But it's just coming. Something else that I think we may see more of, and that certainly I think we have to think about, though I have no real conclusions here because it's new thinking for me, and I think is the whole issue of what drugs are going to be legal and what drugs are not going to be legal, and how should we really think about legalization issues. I think most of us are pretty clear with two extremely dangerous drugs, namely alcohol and tobacco, that prohibition didn't work awfully well. And even the people who make quite a case for how come everything else should be illegal, you know, if you say to them, well, to follow that logic, we should then prohibit alcohol and tobacco again, you know, they don't want to do it. But they do sort of grimly wish to hang on to the current status for other drugs. Okay, where are we? I've been reading stuff in Alcoholism Report, which I still feel to be the most accurate news sheet available to us, by the way, about some of the statements made by White House representatives to the effect that we are winning the war on drugs and that we're having tremendous success. You heard Mark this morning, and it's interesting to me to see how they are measuring success, and it's quite interesting. Success seems to be measured in how many tons of drug you can confiscate. That's one way. And the other piece of success is how many people you can arrest and convict and ultimately put into cages. All right, now if that's success, yes, we're making bigger drug busts than we ever did before. My guess is that as the influx of drugs increases, and there are wonderful crops in South America currently, we are going to make even bigger drug busts with even bigger street values, and we'll probably get even bigger pushers, you know, who've been bringing in more money. I don't think there's any question about it. I think, you know, we've already run out of jail cells in New York. We're already in this problem, as they are in Texas, of having to discharge known criminals, you know, because our jail system is inhumane and we don't want to build, you know, nicer cages to put them in. And this is being dealt with by more mandatory sentences, more arrests, and less possibility of parole. Okay, I think we'll have more cages, more people, you know, bigger busts. Whether it's success or not, I don't know. Because in Miami right now, cocaine is one half the price per weight that it was this time last year, and what you're buying is twice as pure as it was. So basically, you're down to 25% of the price that it was only a year ago. Now, let's assume that we can, though, seal off the borders and have more helicopters and more sniffer dogs and all the rest of it, you know, and interdict more of this stuff. That's fine, but marijuana is already one of our five top crops agriculturally in the United States. We're seeing more and more domestic growing so that people aren't having to seal off borders so much. They're growing all over our national parks, and one of the reasons that people are getting upset about that is that the growers have set booby traps a lot so that hunters and tourists and people who are just out camping in the parks are walking into some of these things that, you know, are killing them. And that's getting kind of messy. People are doing all kinds of indoor marijuana growing with artificial light and underground cellars and all the rest. And then more recently, something else that's kind of cute has come up that we're beginning to see in the press, though not in the medical schools, and that's the whole issue of designer drugs. Is that a term familiar to most of this group, by the way? Yeah. Well, what they're talking about is simply this, that you can make your own narcotics if you're a good chemist, right in your very own lab, for a very, very small amount of money, so that they now have versions of fentanyl turning up on the West Coast, which are not fentanyl. They have some tiny molecular alteration. That came to everyone's attention because they cause a rather interesting form of Parkinson's disease. And here were young people turning up with a rather awful kind of Parkinson's. And it turned out they were all using this, a fentanyl analog. The cops were able to find the person who was making it. You know, so far so good. And they were all set to arrest this guy, except we've got a small problem. It's not fentanyl, so it's not a controlled drug, so the FDA has no authority over it whatsoever, and it is entirely legal. And apparently there's a possibility of making at least 200, psychoactive, analogs of fentanyl alone, much less the others. So it looks as if the underground chemist is going to be able to stay six jumps ahead of the bureaucrats without half trying. And even if they don't, and even if we make the analogs illegal just as an entire class, ban the lot of them before they get discovered, which apparently you can't do. You have to have a sample of the drug before you can ban it. Even if we do that, the profit motive is so enormous that there's very little question that these drugs are going to go right on being made at home. Now, if that's the case, I don't know that it's going to make one whole heck of a lot of difference how we deploy the troops in the Golden Triangle, or what kind of deals we make with various foreign countries to try to stop stuff as it comes over the borders, because there's no need to send it over the borders if you can make it in the backyard. In fact, New Jersey should just be the happy hunting ground for this sort of thing. You've got chemists galore. We're already at a stage where, with the cocaine business, it's the number one or number two crop for at least four nations south of us, most of whom it would be rather unlikely, with an economy dependent on it, to do much of anything really to alter that, except get the current government overthrown, so long as the United States maintains this avid market for as much drug as the rest of the world can create. So I think we're going to be in a position where we've got a tiger by the tail, where our success is not in fact real success, where the thing is going to get increasingly out of hand, and where the best efforts probably come through a form of if you will, education. I don't want it to sound that simple, but as we do get the get word out in the community, as it started happening in California, that cocaine can kill you, and get that taken seriously, or just as we have people now beginning to stop smoking or cut down on it spontaneously because they, are really convinced that this is not such a swift thing to do, I think it may be that that's where we should be putting our money. The thing that fascinates me is that we're in the 60s, we could talk about legalization, and there were groups like Normal, who could beat the drum and, raise a little cane about this. Right now, we almost never are even allowed to discuss it from a speaker's platform. It's all your life is worth to get somebody who will come in and do a debate and be the person in favor of legalization. In fact, I've heard so little from that side of the argument that I'm not even clear in my own head how it ought to go. All right? My impulse, though, is where 10 or 15 years ago, I was saying, no, let's not legalize. Anytime there is increased access, there's going to be more use, and that's going to result in a certain number of deaths, and I still believe that to be true. I'm not sure, but what looking at the total picture, we shouldn't give this some very, very careful thought. And I think we're the folks most concerned about it, and certainly quite able to think about it. And frankly, I'd like to urge you to ask that it be discussed openly in various meetings of drug and alcohol, groups, and let's see if we can't at least learn something. Okay, I think we have to stay open. All right, what else is going on? Naltrexone, of course, has come bursting on the market. We're now to control our opiate addicts, at least, by using that. Some of our colleagues, like David Smith, says that this seems to be a perfectly harmless and okay thing to do, and that we can regard it in pretty much the same breath that we do antabuse. That it should not be regarded in any way, shape, or form as analogous to methadone and merely substituting one addiction for another. I hope that's true. I've had no experience with the drug myself. It's coming up now a great deal as a maneuver suggested to, as a monitoring device for the people who are trying to get the board to give them their licenses back. The board will say, how will we know that Joe is pure? And people will say, test his urine. Then they will say, yeah, but that does not work so well for fentanyl because the stuff is metabolized so fast and goes out of the urine so fast that you'd have to check Joe you know, far too often to be sure that he's behaving. And then somebody says, oh, that's all right, we'll fix the whole thing. We'll put, you know, we'll give him his naltrexone, and that will take care of the problem, because then he can't use. And this is very tempting, you know, a new kind of chemical straitjacket. I hope it works. I hope it turns out to be non-addictive. I hope it turns out to have no serious side effects or drawbacks, because I think we could, using it, get folks back to work that now are simply not being given a chance. But I don't think we know near enough about it. It's one we need to study, keep an eye on, be aware of, you know, think about. If it turns out to, as so many of these things have, to have a hidden price tag, let's be alert to it early. At the same time, let's not throw it out, because Lord knows we need all of the help for folks we can get. A couple of things coming out of my current research that are a little bit new, and it's much too early to really report on any of this, because I've only done about half of the interviews, and I haven't really dug them out in a systematic kind of way. Two things coming from nurses, and this is for an additional one, not the study I was mentioning earlier. Quite a few people, when asked about primary drug of addiction, you know, the one that caused the most problem, rather to my surprise, is saying marijuana. Now, I don't know how that grabs you folks, but I had thought of marijuana, I guess, as just one more of a whole bunch of drugs that people who like to sample everything on the shelves use. I had not thought of it as the one that was going to be named as the number one most troublesome drug with people who'd had a chance to experiment with quite a few. I may get no additional person ever saying that, but there's several already. I was surprised, and I just offer it to you for what it's worth. The other thing I'm running into with the younger women, and this is almost entirely the women now, is that there's a huge population out there that has tried cocaine once or twice and didn't like it. We do know that there are a lot of folks who are kind of an instant love affair with coke. You know, as of the first snort, you know, this is their thing, and they're off and running, and they love it, and they're in serious trouble in a very, very short period of time. The ones I've heard relatively little from are people like these women who are being interviewed for totally different reasons, who are saying, I used coke once. It made me very antsy. It made me nervous. It made me very uptight. I felt like I was walking across the ceiling. I hated it. I never did it again, or I did it once more, had the same effect, and, you know, want no part of it. Insofar as I can pin it down, and this is very iffy, the women who are getting in trouble with the coke and liking it are the same ones who like amphetamines and like the experience of being high, you know, and stimulated, as opposed to liking the downers, which is logical and maybe wrong, because now I'm generalizing from very small groups. I'm increasingly interested, as I have been for the last two or three years, in this whole business of the myth of voluntary treatment in our field. I still see it as one of our biggest potential headaches and one of our biggest time bombs. I've yelled about this at great length, and I'm not going to do it in detail today, but I think one of the things that's our biggest trap, or biggest potential trap, is that our patients sent to alcoholism and addiction treatment are usually not committed, okay? So the myth is that the patient is voluntary, okay? And I've been guilty, as I told people, of saying this, the same kind of thing to people of, you know, the doorknob turns from the inside, you're free to leave at any time you want, Charlotte. Take a suitcase with you, of course, because I'm not sure I'm going to let you back in, but you're not committed. You're entirely free. You can go if you want to. And this is true. They are not committed. Okay? Since they are not committed, they are not entitled to attorneys. They are not entitled to the legal protections that have led to the emptying out of the state hospitals that Dan was talking about. They are not entitled to a hearing or to demand that we establish that we can help them and do something useful for them. Now, plain fact of the matter is that those people, even if you're not concerned about their being organic and, you know, in not very good shape to make decisions for themselves, they are not in a position of being not coerced. I submit to you that if I am sent to treatment by an impaired physicians committee and my license is on the line, or the custody of my children is on the line, or my ability to practice my profession, whatever it is, in a variety of places is on the line, and either I go to treatment or I have no job, no license, no this, no that, there is very little about that that is voluntary. Okay? Now, I don't mind it. Well, I do mind it as a civil libertarian, but I can't fix it because we are self-deluded, we are in our denial, and if we do just look the other direction and let somebody, you know, drink on and on and on year after year, you know, until they arrive at the conclusion that they ought to seek treatment, we're going to go right on watching the deaths, and I don't like that. This room, I'm sure, has a dozen people in it who would not be here if they hadn't been forced into treatment. And I'm all for the forcing. But if we're going to force, I think we have to be darn sure that we're not profiting from it, and I don't mean just profiting in terms of dollars, I mean profiting in terms of status, that what we're really doing is for the good of the patient and not for ourselves and our own needs, and that the coercion is kept as minimal and for as brief a period of time as we can possibly do it and still get the job done. I think we have to be very wary of contracts entered into by referral sources and individual facilities, and that while no one should be allowed to choose a facility that won't do the trick at all, you know, where they can just go and drink and drug on campus and waste everyone's time, they should certainly be given a choice of several different treatment facilities, all of which are good and any one of which might do the job. Or I think we're going to get into a lot of the traps that we already see developing. Okay, and this applies to any patient being sent to treatment. I don't care if it's a physician or whether it's somebody coming in through an EAP program. The kickback is, this system is rampant. The bribes are all over the place. Some people are paying several hundred dollars a head for every patient referred to their particular treatment facility. It's going to get worse before it gets better, and I don't think it adds up to individualized, careful treatment care. I think it adds up to over-treatment, misdirection, and I think we're subjecting alcoholic and addicted people to the kind of care that would be intolerable in other illnesses. And incidentally, I would include in that subjecting them to care under the supervision of someone whose only qualification for that is that he's been treated for his own alcoholism or addiction 6 months ago and has now decided that in spite of a marvelous background in pathology, anesthesiology, or some other psychiatric field, you know, that they are now qualified to treat alcoholic people. As Clara Senegal used to say when she was running her halfway house in Philadelphia, just because you had your appendix out doesn't qualify you to take out mine. It may get you interested, you know, and you can learn, but you're not qualified. I think the thing that applies to a counselor, if I won't hire a counselor with less than 2 or 3 years sobriety, you know, and turn him loose on alcoholic people, where in the name of saints do physicians have the arrogance to think that we're different and that somehow with all the talk about our MDD business and, you know, what a bunch of hardheads we are, that we're any better than those counselors in terms of being sicked on alcoholic patients. I think alcoholics are just as worthwhile as other patients and deserve the same consideration, and that includes competent and trained staff to take care of us. I don't want to go to an amateur who's just out of treatment, please, if I relapse. I want to go to somebody who's really good at this business that I can't outmaneuver. All right, another thing that's going on that we're going to hear more and more about, and it's going to be in a state of flux, is the whole issue of credentials. The more recent history goes sort of like this, and several people have been asking me about this. California developed a separate license for an addiction and alcoholism hospital. They don't call it exactly that, but the word hospital is in the title so that it's eligible for Medicare, Medicaid, and third-party, you know, coverage. The hospital itself can take several different physical forms. It can be a unit within a regular hospital, or it can be a freestanding facility of the, you know, Chit-Chat Hazelden variety that's not necessarily built to hospital specifications. The daily reimbursement rate is not as high as the regular hospital rate, regardless of where the program is housed. And you don't have to go through the same certificate of need procedures, you know, to get a license. However, one condition of the license for that particular kind of hospital is that the physician running it must be certified in the treatment of chemical dependency. Because as I'm sure a bunch of you know, a lot of these places have set up sort of a doc-in-the-box model where they get a physician of any kind who will do the histories and physicals and the are-they-alive function, you know, and he's tossed in with no training whatsoever to take care of our medical needs. All right. The California Society on Alcohol and Drugs, which was a creature of the California Medical Association, independent but funded by them, undertook the job of coming up with an examination and a credential for that California certificate requirement. Other people then were invited, if they chose to do so, to get a certificate through them, and what you can do now, or could do in the recent past, if you wanted to, was to join the California Society, regardless of where in the United States you lived, go out and take a brief course in alcoholism and chemical dependency, and then take a test that would show that you at least knew the ADCs, and they'd give you a little certificate, which wasn't useful for anything but their particular state, but at least
got us started for the first time with some sort of credential in this field, which we have not had. You know, just anybody can practice in the field of addictions right now. There's been a lot of political fighting about that, and I don't particularly want to go into it now, but several different groups all thought that they should be the ones to take care of credentialing or certification or whatever that was going to be. And it was finally agreed that the American Medical Society on Alcoholism would attempt to do the job. So the plan currently is that there will be, sometime later this year, probably late fall, courses analogous to the California one offered in three or four different parts of the country, and that you can then, you know, take that course, then take a little written exam, and come up with a certificate. This is not to be confused with boards. It's not to be confused with a whole subspecialty. It's certainly not to be confused with a specialty, which I think is a long way away if it's ever going to happen. And I personally would be rather opposed to our trying to make a full specialty out of addiction work, because I don't think we have anywhere like, you know, 2 to 3 years of content, you know, to teach people. We keep busy doing research, but I don't think we have that much. I think it would make a neat subspecialty with a training period lasting a few months only, some of those months of training to be offered to the boards of internal medicine, pediatrics, family practice, and psychiatry, so that one could stay within that particular field of primary interest and still have some way to show that they were particularly competent in this kind of disease. But I think we'll see a lot of hair pulling and a lot of political maneuvering, and we'll also see a great rush on the part of people already in the field not to learn anything else, but to come up with some sort of interesting certificate to put on their wall to legitimize what they're doing. I hope, folks, that we will resist that, because if we get into any form of grandfathering or grandmothering in, what I think is going to happen is that we will keep inside you some of the more dangerous people who have simply been the reason why we have to have this kind of attempt to get a credential in the first place. If I'm not willing to go out and do my homework and be tested, then I honestly think I have no business in the field. That means that we may have to come up with some training for some of us who, you know, don't learn all that fast, so that people can learn and can get through and not simply be arbitrarily excluded. But I think we do need to do it. Otherwise, the credential isn't going to mean a darn thing, and we're just kidding ourselves. Okay. Several things going on. Again, referring back to Mark this morning, I think cocaine may turn out to be a very, very interesting thing in our business, particularly for those of us interested in drugs other than alcohol, as well as alcohol. I think for the first time our colleagues are facing the fact that there is a tremendously addictive drug that is not particularly important in the ways in which it creates physical dependency. In some ways, I'm delighted to see cocaine, because I think it's going to force the folks who are wedded to DSM-3, you know, and physical dependency as the measure of addiction, to get out of the kindergarten and over to a definition more like the one Jim Orford at the Maudsley has been using for the past 20 years, which is that we should measure the strength of an addiction in terms of what people are willing to give up rather than give up the use of their drug, and not worry about whether we twitch when somebody takes it away from us or not. Addiction has little to do with detox. Addiction is the thing that takes us from the front step right to the cooker, the day of discharge. Okay? All right, a few more things. I think Al-Anon is facing a bit of a crisis, not in terms of it's coming apart or anything, but I think it has two things going on that are going to make the Al-Anon members, and some of us are members of both groups, do some very hard thinking and face up to the fact that we're going to have to explain our position to people in slightly different ways. First off, we've got this whole Children of Alcoholics movement that's dragging all kinds of folks into Al-Anon, more or less uncomfortably, and is changing the whole chemistry there. But more to the point, we've all, AA and Al-Anon alike, had to back away from the old traditional idea that you couldn't help an alcoholic till the alcoholic was ready, and that you had to wait for an individual to hit bottom. Well, we know now that just isn't so. Period, the end. We don't know how to do primary prevention of this disease at all, you know, sort of lock somebody away from alcohol and drugs for life. But what we do know more and more about is how you do secondary prevention, early case finding, getting people into treatment. And that is exactly what the impaired physician committees or impaired nurse committees or impaired doctor committees or EAP programs are all about. You create the crisis. And incidentally, this is not news. It was not invented by Vern Johnson. You can find this kind of thinking in Harry Thiebaud's papers that you can get from NCA, you know, that were around in the 1950s, where he describes the crisis in the life of the alcoholic or addicted person that makes that individual, quote, spontaneously seek help, and then deals with the whole issue of, do you have to wait for the crisis, or can you create one? You know, and concludes that you can, in fact, create one, and that what you do is going to be very telling. Well, that's exactly what we're doing with the EAPs and the impaired committees. We're saying there is now a crisis, and the crisis is that unless you go for treatment, you're not going to be employed anymore. Okay? There's another way of doing that, and it's known as the DWI program, where it's put in a very reasonable sort of way. You know, you either go for training and or re-education, or guess what? You don't drive automobiles anymore. You know, or perhaps you do a jail term. Okay, another way of doing this is to get the family involved, give them intervention training, and although they can't necessarily threaten job loss, if the whole family, you know, gangs up on their alcoholic person and it's done skillfully, there's a splendid chance that this person is going to get forced into treatment. Now, it's not truly contradictory with what Al-Anon is saying. Okay, it really isn't. But at first blush, it looks like it is, because you're going to have one voice saying you can't do anything until the alcoholic is ready, and your task is to detach with love, which in a way is true, and then another completely different message, which is if you just sit there and wring your hands and let the guy die and don't go out and learn intervention, you're at fault again, lady, and you are so, too, in charge of this whole thing. Okay? I can't resolve it in the brief period of time we've got, but be aware of it. AAs and Al-Anons alike, we're setting people up in what is an apparent, though not a real, conflict, where we simply have to increase our level of sophistication and our understanding of both sides, you know, of this particular negotiation. Then very briefly on AA, and, you know, I'll quit. Dan talks about the way, you know, various professional groups do not understand self-help groups and get on the phone and say, come on over and get this drunk, right? AA is going to be under increasing pressure for a while, I think, by outside people who will be jerking at AA to do different from what it's done in the past. Again, our friend Dave Smith is one who does this a lot. He's constantly reproaching AA groups for not opening the doors wide to any and all drug users of any and all flavors. And in a way, he's right, and I think in a way, he's wrong. Insofar as these groups work because of role modeling and the ability to identify, the flavors of the people going to them should, I think, bear some similarity. Okay? There are many drug users, like people in this room, who are about the same age and the same color and the same caste and class and same background, you know, as each other, and it's rather immaterial whether they stuck needles in their arms or swallowed every pill that would hold still long enough or happened to drink booze. You know, we get along pretty well because we have a common background and the identification is there. If you start scrambling very different age groups, very different social backgrounds, very different motivations for going to a group, and I've seen inner city 19-20-year-old black street heroin people sent to middle class white conservative, you know, Detroit AA groups and closed meetings at that, where the guys frankly didn't want to be there, had no intention of preserving anybody's anonymity, and were mostly motivated to get the chip signed. This does some very, very weird things to AA groups. I think we have to think through what we're going to do. Are we going to be the police that sign the chips, in which case AA is very different from an organization that's entirely voluntary and not an extension of the law? Are we going to bar the doors and keep people out because they happen to have taken the wrong drug, and we've forgotten all about Dr. Bob's being a drug addict and Bill's being on pills? You know, we can do that. Or are we going to bring in people who are so alien and, you know, arrive in such large numbers that our group, instead of meeting openly and dealing with the thing, now turns into a whole set of invitational apartment groups, goes underground, and becomes unavailable to the AA community in its area? And for a while, something like a third of the groups in the Chicago area were not listed in their meeting list at all. You couldn't find them. If they didn't like you, you didn't get invited to the group. Okay? We've got some real problems out there that I think we as AA members have to think of, and I think also we're going to have to look at our obligations. If a group is going to ban the door to the pure cocaine addict who doesn't see himself as an alcoholic, and say, well, you should have your own group. Well and good, but perhaps if we're going to do that, we ought to dig up some more people in the fellowship who've had some cocaine experience who will help the person start that group, or I personally feel we're being bad sponsors and being irresponsible. I'm not totally sure that there are certain people that I could force on my super-conservative Sanibel, Florida, Monday morning women's group and get away with it. You know, enough that we're now allowed to discuss anything we want. We don't spend the meeting in endless liturgy and reading of Chapter 5. And people have gotten beyond saying how wonderful it all is and how we only talk about booze. You know, that group works. But it's taken it a couple of years even to get to, you know, as far along as it is. Okay, I didn't know what I was going to say for an hour. I have now carried on for an hour. I could probably carry on for another. As I say, these are not new thoughts. They're old considerations, but with new problems coming up. I think it's exciting. I think it's fun. I think we'd all die if we weren't, you know, constantly stimulated and challenged. There's new stuff happening all the time. I think it's really going to take up some of our best thought, and hope you'll join me in it. Thank you.